Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, virtually the entire show is dedicated to an interview I did with jazz singer extraordinaire Kathy Siegel Garcia. And I'm not going to say anything more because I want to leave time to play at least two cuts from her CDs. So hang on. Here come the show. The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering you, who you really are, what you might have kept hidden, not only from others, but from yourself. If you've been listening, you know I like to talk for however long I like to talk about that, helping you figure out what you might have hidden, how to discover it, what to do about it. And then, for the rest of the show, I play an interview that I did with someone who has made their living or their life within art, because these are the people in our culture who show the way. They, because it's so hard to be an artist in this culture, are the ones who do it because they must, because it is who they really are. Today, I'm not going to talk very much at all because I'm dedicating the entire show to an interview with, if you were listening in the beginning, you heard me say, the extraordinary Kathy Siegel Garcia. And when you listen to Kathy, you know you are hearing someone who discovered what she was, who she was, what she needed to do very, very early in life, and she grabbed onto it and didn't let go, although she has found many, 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 many clever ways to express her passion, her art, which is singing jazz. And as you will hear Kathy say at the end of the interview, she has in the last 10 years allowed herself to sing really just the way she wants to, which is a more artistic, more expressionful versions of songs, which I know that she has done many, many times, and as she says also late in the interview, straighter, the more the way they're written, the less inventively. So I'm going to play a cut from one of the two albums that she gave me today. This is a song, if this is a song you probably know, called You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To. I want to start with it because you can hear just at the beginning of it the extraordinary clarity and tone and sound of Kathy's voice. And you can also hear her singing straight and then her singing more innovatively. And I'm also going to play a cut from a different album at the end of after her interview. So now I'm going to stop talking and play You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, followed by my interview with Kathy Siegel Garcia.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above. You'd be so to come home to and love. You'd be so nice to come home to. You would be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sing a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire, under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above. You would be nice, you would be paradise
thank you. All right, I am here with Kathy Siegel Garcia in her kitchen.
Yes.
And in Granada Hills in California. I haven't explained to Kathy, so I'm going to do it now. I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist, and I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And I know that's true for you.
Yes.
So, and I know that that art is music.
Yes.
Yes. So, I always ask the same question, and that is, how did it happen? How did you find it? When did it start? How did it find you?
Yes, well, probably another lifetime, but this lifetime, I was raised in a musical family.
Ah.
I had, my mother used to be a singer, and so she was really interested in, you know, singing and acting and all that. And my father was a saxophone player.
Oh.
So when I was born, he was playing sax still, and he played till he passed away. And I had two twin sisters who were 4 or 5 years older than me, right? And they sang. They had really beautiful harmony and voices, and one played the piano. So that was the whole environment.
Mm-hmm.
My dad also was a DJ, so there was always music at the house, and he was very much into like a kind of a straighter jazz, you know, big band stuff, and Rosemary Clooney and Judy Garland and the Four Freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with that.
Yeah.
And Ella Fitzgerald. And so I was, and I was a ham.
You were the baby girl.
I was the baby girl. Mm-hmm. I was just like a little ham bun.
I can see her. She's fluttering her eyes.
Oh, God, yeah.
I bet you were
cute.
Adorable.
Oh, yeah, I was very cute. And so that was how I was attracted to it. Plus, actually, I really do think this is true, embarrassingly so, but I would go to gigs with my dad, right? And then the musicians would flirt with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course.
Yeah.
Little 7-year-old.
I was just going to ask, well, what age were we talking about?
Yeah, I was probably 7 mm-hmm. to begin with, you know, and I think that's part of I was really kept drawing into that, you know?
Oh, they like me. They like me. It's so much fun.
Right. Oh, I love this.
I love this, right.
Yeah. So cute.
Yeah.
And then also we lived in a small house and my dad taught every Saturday and Sunday morning.
Sax?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my room, my bedroom was right next to the living room. So I got all that, you know, as I was waking up and stuff.
Osmosis.
Yeah, definitely osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the very beginning, and then, you know, it went on through all
the
time.
Well, so now did you study?
Yeah, I had various...
I mean, did they encourage the girls to think of this as a career? Did your sisters...
Well, here's what... Let's see. My sisters, being twins, was kind of like a little commodity.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so they worked on that. But there was a point where my sisters... And several things could have happened, but my sisters decided to kind of go the straight life. And then I did kind of your typical... lessons, kid lessons, guitar, and then I started on flute. And flute was actually the instrument that got me through and into a few years of college at Berkeley in Boston. And because when I went there in the early 70s, they didn't have vocal at the time. So
in order to get in...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So did you know you wanted to sing, and you were using the flute? Yes,
I was like a
see
singer.
The look on her face.
Oh, yeah. Right. I was just a singer forever.
Right.
But, I mean, I wasn't opposed to flute either. I liked flute. But when I was in college, I was doing arranging and composition and flute. But I was very young, and I was really actually a very... There was about, I bet, 5% women in the school.
I was just going to say.
Yeah. So you can imagine. I was 20.
Oh, having a good time.
5% women.
I see.
I was... It was too distracting.
I'll bet.
However, I did really, I would say that time period was really important because that was where I really felt like that it was my own, you know,
yes.
How it felt to arrange music and to be around musicians and to, you know, I really decided.
It was no longer a part of the family thing. Mm. It was really yours.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the early 70s. And remember the great music
remember
that was
it.
Happening?
I do.
Like, you know, we're coming out of that Aretha Franklin, all that era, you know, with Chaka Khan, Aretha, also like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And then the jazz was like it was going into Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and also ECM, like Weather Report, and Pat Metheny.
Right.
It was a really great period for music, you know, really rounded. So I was pretty excited by music. Then I moved to California.
And why did you move?
I just wanted to get away, and I wanted to see the
more
world.
More of the life of my own.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I went to San Francisco for a few months, and like 6 months, I think, at the most. But it was too much like Boston. So much to everybody's like trying to convince, don't go to LA, you'll hate it. I came to LA, and then a few years later, I was going to actually move to New York, mm-hmm. but I met my first husband. And so he was very charismatic, and he was not a working musician, but he was a composer, and he played great guitar. And so that was when I started composing with him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the rest, I just kept building up my, you know, work. And
Talk about it, how it happened and how it started, and then tell what it is.
Yeah, well.
What it is.
I would say that period, let's see.
So when are we talking, 73, 75?
Yeah, 75, I think I moved to San Francisco. And then 6 months later, I moved here. And then I got a job at Dante's, which was the jazz club here, mm-hmm. right? And that turned out to be a really one of those moves that we were talking about, mm-hmm. you know, like it kind of forms your future, right?
Yeah.
Because I was there for a year and a half.
Playing? Singing?
No, waitressing.
Waitressing?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And I was 21.
Right.
And so I became friends with the musicians.
Oh, yeah, they were all there then.
Yeah, and I started sitting in, and it was terrific. You know, I met a whole bunch of really wonderful, you know, great jazz musicians, and really got, you know, an idea of what was going on. And my boyfriend was a guitar player. We were trying to stir stuff up. Then somebody came and sang, who shall remain nameless, came and sang at Dante's, who was my age. And I was like, I can do this or better, you know. And so I decided I was going to sing. And around that time, a legendary guitar player had come in, and we met. It was kind of a funny meeting because he fainted, and I helped him. His name was Ted Green. Mm-hmm. And so I had heard about Ted Green at Berkeley because it was very guitar heavy, and he was like really well-known. What I didn't know was that he was a very quirky guy, and he hadn't worked for several years because of his own issues and standards with his own playing. And so we got together and played, and so I said, can we, you know, want to do a gig? And he said, okay. I didn't know he hadn't worked for years.
Oh, my God.
And I went out and got this, you know, this gig at a place called The Sound Room. We were like the first live band that the guy hired, and I had to convince him. So I put up maybe 4 signs, and when I got to the gig, there was no standing room.
Coming to see him.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
totally.
I know. Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, pretty blown away. Mm-hmm. And anyway, we did that for a year and a half. And then I started spreading out into the community. There were a lot of gigs happening in town at that time. And like the Money Tree was like really happening then. Karen Hernandez and Eugene Wright were playing there. And you could actually have a gig for a week there. Mm-hmm. Like a whole week. And there were people like me, you know, young singers, that would have a week at a time. So there were a bunch of gigs like that. Plus, at that time, I was also doing casuals, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of work happening if you just went after it.
Right.
So, and then I'm the kind of person, you just attract people, you look for people, you find the best in people,
right.
And
they're drawn to you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So I just started getting a lot of friends, and you know, and plus working at Dante's, you know, of course helped in that as well. And so, and then I got married to Gus Garcia, and that was interesting. He was 11 years older than me, so he was a little kind of forceful into directions, and we were writing together, And he helped me get this gig at a place called the $2 Bills. It was a local club, but people like Chick Corea played there, and then local people like me. And I got a Tuesday night gig there for, I think it was 3 years.
Wow.
And what was funny about that gig was, what they paid was $5 and a meal to anyone who showed up in my band. And so you can imagine $5 and a meal, you know, I couldn't get certain people to show up, and then certain people I could. But so sometimes I would have really weird bands. Like one time I had trumpet and percussion and bass, you know. And so, but on that gig, I learned so much. I mean, and my husband was very spiritually strong and adventurous. He was a Chicano, and, you know, that probably had something to do with it, because Mexican ideas are, you know, I mean, spiritual, of course, you know.
Right.
So he led me into these kind of cognitions that I had that were really good, like, for instance, how to not be nervous on stage, you know, that kind of thing, but with his spin on it.
Oh.
So I really learned a lot there, and I also learned about my charts.
Do you want to tell us how not to be nervous on stage?
Well, for me, it worked. You know, I mean, I'm a teacher, so I know, you know, there's many different aspects. But, well, one thing he said was that the universe that I was aware of was my universe. So anything that happened in my universe was my creation.
Oh, wow.
So if the guy over there was snorting or laughing or farting or whatever, that was in my universe, you know. So it made it safe. It made it like,
it's just part of the thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really developed a very strong perspective that I definitely pass on to my students with that, you know, because the stuff is so hard to talk about, music and perspectives, and, you know, it's not material universe stuff, but it's real.
Yeah.
Right?
So so in a way you're making everything inclusive.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Right. This is all me, essentially.
Yeah.
So how could it be bad?
Right.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, and it kind of puts you in control.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it's really nice.
It's lovely.
Yeah.
And actually, if you forgive me, you know, if you extrapolate, you know, you make that in the world, then you don't have to be
the effect of anything.
Exactly.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Suppose.
You already went there, right?
No, I did.
That is your life, right?
I got it.
Yeah, right.
Now, and, you know, but of course there's
very Buddhist.
Oh, it is very Buddhist. Yeah. And there's things that happen, but the thing is, then all of a sudden, it's the responsibility is yours.
Yes, and you're not laying it off on someone else. So you're not saying, "Oh, why is this happening to me? How come they're doing this and all that?"
Right.
You don't get lost in any of that.
No,
it's great.
Yeah, and if somebody is a turkey, then and you can't handle it, then you say, "Oh, well, I can't handle that. Now I have to go learn how to handle that." You know,
that's my job.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. Okay, so now we have you at $2 Bills.
Yes.
And you've got, what did you say, 3 years?
3 years. Every Tuesday night.
So you're clearly not making a living doing this.
Definitely not. I'm making a living, like, my husband and I have a cleaning business.
Cleaning houses?
Cleaning
Things like that,
businesses,
you mean? Right, yeah, that
drugs.
Kind of cleaning.
Oh, God.
Oh, nice.
Never do that again.
Yeah, you were young.
Exactly.
Right, okay. So then...
Yeah. So then I was one of these people that for some reason, maybe because I had this 3-year gig, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept putting my name in the paper. People would always think I was working. Around that time, there was a lot of original music going on in LA. And that was another expansion. Did you ever go to the Comeback Inn in Venice?
Mm-hmm.
So we played there, and a whole bunch of people were playing there. Everybody from John Pisano to down to, you know, somebody like me, right? And so that was another expansion, and I was doing original music. And then I started teaching. What happened was my girlfriend was teaching. At some point, she left town. she had to turn her students over to somebody, and she turned them over to me, and I said,
magic.
I'm a teacher, and she said, do you think that you can give them something as a person? And I said, oh, yeah. She said, well, that's really what they're coming to you for. It's you personally, you know. So I said, oh, okay, I can do that, you know. So I started teaching. Mm-hmm. And that really was a real long, solid path, you know, developing. But what I started doing was I also, you know, once I started teaching, I also started doing these workshops, which I've been doing now for maybe 15 years. And a few workshops every month. And either I would be the clinician, or I would have visiting artists coming through town, or mm-hmm. some people from town. And like 3-hour workshops on a weekend for $40 or $30 or whatever.
And what happens in them?
Well, various things. Like, let's say, like this weekend I have a workshop with Mark Winkler on how to make a CD. So everything from that to singing, like people will get up, I'll have a piano player, they'll get up, they'll sing. Sometimes I do it on business stuff, and then lots and lots of people have come through here. Great people. Mark Murphy has done stuff for me, and Rebecca Paris, and Nancy King, and, you know, Nancy Marana, Jay Clayton, all these really great.
Yeah. Right,
yeah.
Right. So people sing and they critique?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do it specifically like on scat or, you know, various things. And so I've gotten a bit of a reputation in the planetary music jazz singing community. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to L.A. Let's call Kathy and see if we can get a workshop going, and sometimes a gig, too.
Right.
But that was a really interesting arm.
And so it's a niche for you now.
It's a niche, and it was a way for me to hook up with people and get my name out there. It's good advertising.
Yes, right.
And I get to know the really great people who are doing it on the planet, and also I attract students by doing it. It helps everybody. It's really, it's good. So I started doing that. And I always had this community, and I was part of generating a good community feeling amongst jazz singers here in L.A., you know, and people would recognize that and, you know, attribute that to partly to me. So that was good. So that's what I was, kept creating all that stuff. Meanwhile, I was still writing. And then I started recording over the years, so now I have like 6 CDs, and I just actually recorded a new one. And, that was another little thing I wanted to tell you, actually, that came up a little earlier. In 85, Gus and I made a recording. It was our first recording. We had a lot of original material on it, and it was kind of new agey, you know. And but actually some really classic arrangements. And I could not get a deal for that. I shopped around for like 5 years and just nobody wanted it, right? And so then I decided, I had a talk with a friend of mine who was a sculptor. And he said one sentence to me, which I don't remember what it was, but it totally changed my perspective. And I thought, oh my God, I've been so looking down the wrong path. And so I decided not to focus on that anymore and to focus just on being the best singer I could be and having, you know, singing. Well, a month later, a friend of mine called who was a really good critic, for a jazz critic, Zan Stewart. He called me and he said he had bumped into somebody that he knew on the street who was looking for a jazz singer and a piano player to go for 1 month, which was short, to Japan.
Oh my.
For a jazz gig.
Wow.
So that became me. I took a wonderful piano player, this guy named Wilbo Ware, and while I was there, I met a Japanese man who owned a music school and a recording label, and he decided to start bringing me out twice a year, and this was back in 1990, twice a year, and hooking me up with a great piano player who was on his staff, who was an American guy, kind of like a Keith Jarrett type of player, Phil Strange. And as soon as I basically started doing that, he took my first project and put it out on a record. And so so that was another thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, because we had talked about before, you know, when things happen or don't happen,
right?
You know, what do you think? What do you do? And so that actually was a huge thing that happened for me. And it didn't take too long, but it taught me, oh boy, that was just, I was focusing on the wrong thing. Well, it's like writing. I was writing, and all this really simple stuff was coming out at this one point, and I was like, ugh. And I kept trying to, you know, change it, and it just
hit it up.
Yeah, and that was what was coming out at that time,
right.
You know, like little folk songs and stuff, you know. But I stopped writing for like a year, and then I realized, like, hey, oh, I have not been writing for a year because I'm stopping my flow.
Right.
So I'm just going to write anything. I can throw it out, you know.
That's right. So now you're running. Oh, well, this was Japan. This was earlier then. Now you're teaching. It's later, right?
Oh, yeah, let's see. Well, Japan started early, but continued.
How long did it last?
Well, pretty much till now.
Wow.
I mean, I haven't been there in a year and a half, I think, because as the last 6 or 7 years have gone, the economy's gotten a little worse there, and so I've gone over less continually. But for probably 10 years, I'd say, something like that, I was going 2 and 3 times a year.
Oh, it's lovely.
Yeah, it was nice. And so that was good. And he produced several records for us.
Wow.
And one with Peter Erskine and Mark Johnson. Yeah, so it was great. Yeah. So that continued, and that was a whole... That was actually a good thing for my artistic expression.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I was forced to be with this guy, Phil Strange, who played like Keith Jarrett. So it was like,
wow.
You know, we were doing standards, but we were doing them like
Strange.
Like Keith Jarrett, yeah. And and then being in Japan, you get this feeling that you can do anything. You can make mistakes. You can be adventurous because you're in a foreign country. You know, either nobody knows you where you're in this little tiny little club that holds 40 people and they love whatever you're doing,
right.
Or you know, there's, and then Phil in his high standards, you know. So you really, as a singer, you're really
taking
trying,
risks.
Yeah,
right. you're reaching,
good,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. Yeah.
So that was, I mean, we just, Phil and I are just, you know, just a really great pair. And when we see each other again and get together again musically, it's always at the next level. It's really good. And we traveled in Europe a little bit together too. But so that Japan, that whole thing in Japan was a really strong arm for me,
mm-hmm.
You know, great. I really loved it. Okay, here's another little thing that I developed. You're going to laugh at this probably, but, you know, L.A. was, you really had to, as you know, you really had to work hard to get things going.
Yeah.
And being from Boston, you know, and having friends on the East Coast who were doing things,
yeah.
Right?
You know that this is weird.
Yeah, and so what I decided was that Boston or New York, there was a big wheel turning, and the challenge was to jump on the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And in L.A., there's no wheel turning,
no.
And the challenge is to build the wheel.
Oh, yes.
And it was,
oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And, you know, I mean, I kind of got a little of that from reading American Indian books, where they describe how they, or in the old days, they had the shields, the medicine shields, and on the shields they would paint who they were in color and animals. And those things, color and animals, represented also locations, east, west, north, south. And for instance, south was a mouse, and the mouse could see extremely well close, but not far away. So it would reflect who they were.
Right.
So they would paint this on the shields, and wherever they would travel, even if they didn't speak the same language,
people would know.
They would know, and they would help them.
Because they would see what they could, what they needed.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Isn't that lovely?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Imagine.
I know, imagine. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's astonishing.
Isn't it beautiful?
It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Talk about a sense of community, you know, that
Mankind,
that everybody is on your side looking to help you, and that you can wear your heart on your sleeve, literally, so that people can see it and help you, as opposed to what we have, which is armor, so nobody hurts you.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It's amazing, huh?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so you were building a medicine shield, essentially?
Yeah. Now, what was I telling you? Why did I tell
you? You were building the wheel, so you'd have
the wheel
to jump on.
So I just figured, because I had read that book in college or something, and I just realized, because my girlfriend in New York was, she was just real adventurous, and she was really edgy, and I was like, wow, she's really developing in a different way than I am. I'm developing, like, my business chops, but more of my business chops. I wonder why that is, and then I figured out my little comparison. So I was always doing business and art and trying not to let the art go, you know, and you feel, as an artist, if you're at all dedicated to your art, you feel when you've reached a plateau and you need to find the next plateau. Sometimes you get depressed over it. Sometimes you talk with your girlfriends about it, you know. You talk to musicians about it. You know, you're searching for somebody who's going to open the door again, you know, and like start the new,
Right.
So that was always going on throughout. And, you know, there were different wonderful things that happened, and then different periods of time where it was just
plateau.
I got a divorce. So, and actually, it was actually after my divorce that I started the workshops. I hooked up with a saxophone player, this guy from Houston named Harold Bennett. And so I started my workshops, and then I started a jam session.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
right.
That was the next reaching out into the community thing.
How long did you do that?
Well, it's still going on, and it's
really
it's in its 10th year. Recently, we found a new home, which is going to start in October, October 3rd. Now we're going to do it on Sundays, 6:30 to 10:30, at the Wine Bistro. It's a real new generation. The whole band that I was working with before can't do it.
Wow.
So it's really a new generation, because those guys really were there the whole 9 years.
Wow.
So, but anyway, that was a real significant gig.
Mm-hmm.
It really reached out into the community.
I mean,
attracted so many people from everywhere. And, you know, it was a friendly session. And and I always watched how the production of it was going. So, because I discovered that if I let the session run itself, usually didn't work out as well. The quality was not...
So what did you have to do?
Well, I just kind of... I watched who was getting up. I kind of mixed and matched people. I sometimes called people out of order.
Because it would fit better now if you had a female, not another male, or somebody who sang a different style or something
like
that, right?
Right, like if two weak people were going to get up, I would probably not do that.
Right.
Put instrumental in between, like...
Right, right.
10 singers, or you know,
right,
what I mean?
Right, right.
Also, I didn't really want a singer showcase. I wanted a jam session.
Yeah,
you
right,
know?
Right.
And so that turned some people off, but turned some people on. You know.
Yes.
Because, you know, singers
want to sing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots
right.
of singers, you know, and I didn't want to put singers off, but
right.
I wanted them to know this is the real world. You know, it's not all about you, and you know, people are going to be playing. You know,
right.
and And so just so many great, great lessons came out of the jam session. Oh, you know, just total hookups and friends got friendly. And then the California Pop and Jazz Council grew out of that, which was an organization that's probably like 4 or 5 years old now. And this guy came and he said, why don't we create a group? And at that time, I guess I was starting to produce these ideas more, you know. And, you know, it's always harder to get people to come out to your single gig. Mm-hmm. And I just realized that early on, and so I started creating these gigs with other people. Mm-hmm. And
then there are lots of people to draw from.
Yeah, like, you know, you get four singers to do a show together, right. And everybody's, you
bringing
know,
people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but part of, actually, that wasn't the reason that I had created this other thing at the bakery, the jazz bakery. Mm-hmm. And Ruth Price and I were friends, you know, and I admired her and she admired me. And and so she allowed me to try out a lot of different ideas there. And so this idea came to me because of the jam. I kept seeing all these people who were older and who hadn't performed for a while, but were really great, you know, and they weren't so experienced, but they really, I thought they deserved to have something, you know.
Yeah.
So I created this show at the Jazz Bakery, and this guy came along right at that time, Robert Walker, and he gave me a name for it called The Four Souls of Jazz, which I loved. So I started doing that at the bakery, and then out of that, and Robert grew this group of people, which we named the California Pop and Jazz Council. And it turned out to be about 50 people. We still have, you know, it's still together, although we're not super active right now, but have a website and all that. And we've done three-year annual events, awards. The first one was at the bakery, and it was for Deanie Clark, in honor of Deanie Clark. And then the second one was in honor of Howlett Smith. Mm. And then the third, which we just did in June, was Herb Jeffries.
Ooh.
So, and those were at Catalina's. So, in between, we were doing, you know, kind of group shows and various ideas where, you know, you get a group of people together and coming up with ideas and stuff. So, I've been the president.
No.
So, that was another expansion into the community. And
so what are you doing now?
So I'm president of the organization. And then there's the jam. I'm still doing workshops. Right now I'm writing a book on guitar and voice, jazz guitar and voice, ooh, with a guitarist. And I just recorded a new record and with a Korean jazz pianist who's exceptional, which leads me to an ex-student of mine, a young Korean man named Jun Lee. He opened, in December, he opened a jazz club down near Japantown called the Blue Whale. And so I'm kind of his jazz mother, basically. So now I'm actually doing some work for the Blue Whale, PRing and advising him, mm-hmm, and, you know, being kind of a hostess of the Blue Whale, you know. So that's another thing that I've been focusing on. And there's a few other things that I'm doing that take a bit of time, but not too much time. Like I'm producing monthly shows for a nonprofit group right around the corner, a very small place called More Art. And I've been doing that for about a year. And teaching, I teach at Occidental and also Cal State LA. And
you're just an idea machine.
Yeah, you know, it just keeps quiet me up.
I know, I love it. And so it doesn't actually matter where in your life you are, it's just the next thing is coming.
Yeah, and in the last 2 years, I had reached an artist plateau. I wasn't finding fault so much with people outside of myself. It was more like, there's something going on, and yeah, I haven't really fully digested what I need to do to move on, and what is it? And I found myself kind of lethargic about it. But a lot of different things were happening in my life. You know, my sister was sick, and the California Pop and Jazz Council had my attention, and so I was kind of like, And finally, probably with the Blue Whale too, you know, with the coming in of the Blue Whale, I realized, I want to be really artistic. I mean, in my singing. I really want to sing.
What does that mean?
Well, like, you know, the jam, at the jam, mm-hmm. I sing straight ahead,
right.
Mostly, you know. And I never considered that to be my highlight singing. I mean, I can swing, I can sing pretty ballads, you know, and that is, especially ballads, has been a highlight over my career that people have talked about and stuff, and that I love. But I also have this really love for more modern, and by that I mean more instrumental-like, more space, harmonically a little challenging and stuff. So I really like that direction, you know, mm-hmm. and I think I do well at that direction. Mm-hmm. I think that I had maybe for a while gone down the path of the West Coast working on the business part.
Yes.
You know, I think I was too much into that, and so my singing, I felt like I was trying to please the audience mm-hmm. a little bit more than pleasing myself, which you always want to do.
Well,
you know, I mean, mm-hmm. but you also do want to hold to your art. But this time I decided, okay, I'm going to hold more to my art and see what happens. Now this goes back again to
yes.
our discussion.
Right.
Because I think, I don't know if I ever totally committed to that line, and I'd like to see what happens if I really do totally commit to that line,
mm-hmm.
And just really do whatever I want to do.
Right.
And will I attract more attention? Or maybe I won't. And if I don't, okay, that's fine. So in the last 10 months or so, that's what I've been doing. I haven't been working as much, but the jobs that I have been working at, I've been really doing that.
And how's it going?
I love it. I just love it. I come home happy. You know, I just come home, I'm like,
woo!
Yeah. That felt really good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do. I know exactly what you mean.
So that's my path right now, mm-hmm. and I haven't been writing all that much, but that will come back at some point. But I'm just really happy to even be doing the songs, picking the songs that I want to pick, and picking the players that I want to play with, and
doing what you do.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I did something else too. I invited two professional jazz singers, and then
right.
I interviewed them and had a piano player there and had them both sing.
Oh,
and sing
lovely.
We all sang together once.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that several times at the Jazz Bakery.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I still would like to continue doing that because mm-hmm. it feels good.
Okay, so here's my final
question.
It doesn't mean you have to stop talking. It's just it's my final question. Just having really lived an entire life dedicated to this music.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say about what it feels like to have lived a life dedicated to an art?
I can't imagine not having a perspective and reality that art isn't a part of. However, there were moments over my life, like there was a time when I was selling 3D cameras. And I realized, why am I putting all this effort into this? I should just put the same exact effort into selling myself. But I realized that in one way, art exists only for itself. And a little broader than that, art exists for each one of us to experience, and, you know, and do. And then broader than that, to share with the masses or whomever. But for me, it's not enough just to have it for myself. It's gratifying, but it seems like that exists to share. So it's like that's the core of it, but then it's not all of it.
No, and as you're saying this, I'm thinking back on what you said, and you kept saying over and over and over, I reached out, I made communities, I brought people together, it's always been about that for you.
Yeah.
It's almost as though the art is the vehicle through which you do that.
Yes.
You know?
And I actually had a realization about that a few years ago, because I was doing one of those life kind of plan things, right? And I was looking at my goals and purposes. And I realized what really makes me happy is when I do something that's good for me and good for other people.
Yes.
I don't...
It's not enough for you.
Yeah, it's not the selfish kind of... And I don't mean... I think some people do fine with that, but...
No, that's not yours.
Me, no.
That's not yours. It's about connection. You said it over and over. I connected.
Yeah.
I touched people. People touched me. I met them. I learned. I finally, over and over,
yeah.
It was about that. In every single, almost every single event.
Yeah.
And all of the ideas, they're all about bringing people together, making a space for people to do it. It's all about that.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah. It's so good, isn't it?
It's so good.
I mean, especially, expanding on that idea of your universe.
Yes.
This is how I cannot be Mother Teresa and be happy. If I do really well in my universe, everything in my universe, everything that I'm aware of, everything, the dog down the street, the Japan, everything, right? That everything improves when I improve. And everything degrades if I degrade. So in that way, I am responsible for everybody and everything I know, but
all you have to be is the best you can.
Exactly. And I realize, I'm in your universe right now, too, right?
That's right.
So this is a shared universe. But still, that doesn't take away the fact that I am responsible for you while you're in my universe, And so that's... I think that lies behind a lot of my actions.
So... For this period of time that I have been in your universe, you have done really beautifully.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you.
It's always a little awkward, talking about yourself so much.
Well, let me assure you, there is nothing awkward about you.
Oh.
You are wonderful. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
So there you have it, listening to Kathy lets you hear what it is like to really be taken by a passion, by an art. So much so that it informs everything that you do in your life. And I don't have any more time, so I'm simply going to thank, as always, the intrepid, the unable to do without, Josh Hackney. Tell you that you can find out more about me and also more about Josh by going up on my website, thelinshow.com, thelinshow.com. I'm going to go out on another cut from the second album that Kathy gave me. And this one is called Heart to Heart. The other one was called Alone Together. And this is exactly like you. And, what I want you to hear is that she does it mostly straight, and then she does her thing afterwards. It's extraordinary. If you want information about Kathy, you can get that at www.kathysiegelgarcia.com, or you can go up on my website and ask me for more information about her. So as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be here again next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too. Now I know why my mama taught me to
I'm dreaming, scheme, I'm scheming. Now I know why Mama taught me to be true. She meant me for someone like you.
Time that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly.